Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Later in today's program, we will have Mara Gay from the New York Times editorial board. I know many of you are talking about this. The New York Times endorsed two candidates for president of the United States yesterday. You probably know something they've never done before, Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren. And we've got a member of the editorial board, Mara Gay, to come on and explain it and take your questions about it. That'll be at the end of the show today, so that'll be at about 11:30 in about an hour and a half. We'll also have our own On the Media co-host, Bob Garfield, who has a new book that is both a critique of the media and of tribalism, including identity politics in this country. His book is called American Manifesto, Saving Democracy from Villains, Vandals, and Ourselves. So Bob Garfield coming up today, and we will have the Nassau County executive, Laura Curran. She is among those calling to reform the bail reform that took effect in New York State on New Year's Day. So some really interesting guests, some really important conversations, a lot of opportunity for you to weigh in and ask questions today as well. Hope you can stay with us. But first, how many days are there in 24 hours? Wait, don't I mean how many hours are there in a day? No. How many days are there in 24 hours? That apparently will be one of the first big debates in the trial of Donald Trump today. We'll explain in a minute. Another one might be, what exactly do we mean by the word exactly? Listen to Mitch McConnell here from the other day.
What was good enough for President Clinton in an impeachment trial should have been good enough for President Trump. And all we're doing here is saying we're going to get started in exactly the same way that 100 senators agreed to 20 years ago.
So when McConnell says they'll get started exactly the same way they did 20 years ago, with the impeachment of Bill Clinton, well, not exactly. We'll start there with Slate senior editor Jeremy Stahl. And not to gloss over where he's coming from, Stahl's latest article is called Meet Trump's Deplorable Impeachment Team. Jeremy, great to have you. Thank you for coming on.
Hi, Brian. Thanks.
All right. How many days are there in 24 hours? I think Mitch McConnell wants the answer to be two.
So previously in Bill Clinton's trial, the days in 24 hours would have been 4 6-hour days. Now, yes, as you know, Mitch McConnell is saying something different from exactly what the impeachment rules for Bill Clinton's trial would have been in 1999, and saying now that those are 2 days and that they will be two very, very long days and that will stretch late into the night for the House managers to make the case against Donald Trump.
And so that's the answer to the second question, or it's at least implied that is not exactly like the Clinton trial opening arguments, though McConnell had said he wanted this to be exactly like that. But is this really such an advantage for Trump? I can imagine that if this pushes the arguments into prime time for a few nights, rather than just the 4 afternoons apiece that you just said they did during Clinton, 6 hours a day, I think it was 1 to 7 p.m., there would be more people seeing the Democrats make their case this week in prime time. Or do you think I'm missing something?
Well, what I would say from having attended some of these hearings in the impeachment inquiry and having watched almost all of them going back to the Mueller probe is that when those days stretch out long, they get very long. And I think that people really only tune in for the first few hours often for these public hearings.
But I'm just saying the television audience, most of the American public, they're not tuning in from 1 to 3 p.m. because they're at work or otherwise living their lives. So maybe if they do wind up backloading some of this into 8 o'clock Eastern, 9 o'clock Eastern, 10 o'clock Eastern, everybody will get more, or more Americans will get more engaged with the arguments per se.
Yeah, that's a fair point, and I honestly couldn't say how the timing works out. These are different than, you know, the House hearings, certainly, as you know, the schedule itself will look different, and the format will be much different.
But clearly, McConnell and Trump think this is to Trump's advantage. Is it clear to you why?
I think the idea is, and it's something that they've been saying, both the Senate leadership and the president have been telegraphing either directly or indirectly for the last month, is that they want as short as trial as possible. They want a quick and what they would call a clean acquittal or dismissal. And, you know, cutting the number of days that this trial is certainly would serve that purpose.
Next controversy. I see there's a provision in McConnell's rules proposal that says not only will it take a Senate vote to admit new evidence, they'll also have to vote to even admit the existing evidence from the House hearings. Have you figured out what, if anything, that actually restricts?
No, and it's very confusing. I've tried to speak with you know, at least one source on the Hill about that, and it seems that they are even a bit confused about what that provision would actually do. But in sum and substance, it says that there would be a vote, the vote to admit the record that the House managers and the House impeachment inquiry have already collected wouldn't come until the end of the House managers' presentation. So it's very confusing as to how the House managers would present a case without their evidence having been admitted yet. But I guess the notion is they'll present their case, they'll show their evidence, and then they'll request everything they presented to be admitted at the end of the trial. And, you know, presumably the Senate Republicans will not block that much, but who knows?
Yeah. Once they get into the speeches by Adam Schiff and his cohorts on the Democratic side and Dershowitz and everybody on the Trump side, is there anything that actually stops them from saying whatever they want? Like, if Adam Schiff wants to get up and talk about new evidence, like, okay, Lev Parnas dropped all these documents and they show that, for example, Rudy Giuliani approached the president of Ukraine and said, I'm representing President Trump as his personal attorney, not on behalf of the United States, and that kind of proves something about abuse of power. Can Adam Schiff not stand there and say that because that happened after the articles of impeachment were voted on?
So what you'll have is you have a submittal of evidence at the beginning, and what the Senate rules lay out is that the House managers will have to have submitted everything they want as evidence at the beginning. And if they stray outside the bounds of that because new evidence emerges or for whatever reason, then yes, theoretically, Trump's legal team could object if they bring in outside evidence. And then you have a ruling of the presiding officer, who is Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, and or potentially a vote to overrule any ruling by Justice Roberts.
Listeners, your questions, anything impeachment related as the trial gets underway today for Jeremy Stahl, senior editor at Slate, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Our live coverage starts today at noon, so that will be 1 hour technically before they begin. There will be kind of a pregame show. There also, Jeremy, do you know, I gather there might be some action between 12 and 1, even though 1 o'clock is the official start time. Do you know what's going to be happening in that first hour?
I actually am not clear what sort of, formal procedural mechanisms might be happening. Last week, a lot of the formalities were kind of already undertaken in terms of swearing in the Senate as the jury and swearing in Chief Justice Roberts as the presiding officer. So a lot of those like big formalities and kind of elaborate display has already taken place. And I'm not sure myself what's going to be going on in the hour on the floor itself in the lead up to that, to the beginning of the trial.
All right. But listeners, our live NPR coverage from Washington will begin at noon today, and it will go as long as it takes. Also, as a program note, we don't know exactly when they might go into closed session for periods of time, or there might be gaps where we'll be able to come on and take your calls, Allison Stewart or Jamie Floyd or me. or some of the others of us here, or how the NPR coverage will fill those gaps. It's going to be, you know, all uncharted territory. So just
there'll be plenty to talk about, though, presumably.
You think?
I think these votes are going to be interesting and exciting, and you know, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has already promised repeatedly that he's going to force votes on some of these key contentious issues of whether or not to allow witnesses and evidence early on in this trial, as opposed to at the end of the trial, when presumably Mitch McConnell is hoping that his caucus will just vote it down. And some of those votes are certainly the way that Mitch McConnell has been projecting their fait accompli, and, you know, that they're going to be rejected. But it'll be interesting to start to see the groundwork of which Republicans, senators vote which way, and how they might be, how uniform the caucus is on these initial votes. And, you know, it's an impeachment trial. It's a trial. I think there's going to be plenty to discuss and plenty to be interested in, even in this first day of setting up the rules.
You know, what's one procedural question that only occurred to me last night, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but when they get to the portion where the senators ask questions, we know they ask the questions through Chief Justice Roberts. So if they want to ask a question of Adam Schiff to challenge him or to bring him out on something, or if they want to ask a question on the other side of Ken Starr, whoever, and bring him out on something, or challenge him, the question gets delivered by a senator in writing to Chief Justice Roberts. Now, what if the impeachment manager who's receiving the question ducks the question? What if they say, what do you mean Rudy Giuliani was acting on behalf of Trump as his personal lawyer, thereby helping to prove abuse of power? Why does that prove abuse of power? And Adam Schiff says something irrelevant. Will Chief Justice Roberts play moderator? Will he do like what I would do and say, well, you know, you didn't really answer the question. So the question was this. Please answer the question.
No, I'm not going to duck this question. I'm going to try not to, because I know you'll ask a very smart follow-up, but I don't think that Adam Schiff or Ken Starr or Alan Dershowitz has to be worried about Chief Justice Roberts doing the same. He's just going to be, from what I understand, basically, you know, parroting and serving as a vessel for these senators' questions. And I also think, you know, that's one of the more fascinating parts of this, because it could have a bit more weight and authority having the questions come directly from this person who is supposed to be a model of our Supreme Court and of our separate third institution that is outside of Congress and outside of the White House and supposed to be this independent branch speaking for these senators. And it might be more awkward to duck, but there won't be any follow-up from just Chief Justice Roberts. Senators might ask follow-ups, but not the Chief Justice.
So he's going to be more game show host than Andrea Mitchell. You know, what we have here is a new car, and the question is, do you like the new car? Okay, your article on Slate calling Trump's legal team deplorable. We talked a lot yesterday about Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz, and everybody's talking about them ad nauseum. But you also highlight Robert Ray, who, like Starr, was also a Clinton-era independent counsel. Something about him and stalking?
Yes, there was an arrest in, I guess it was 2006, and, you know, a person accused him of sending emails and visiting against her wishes after the relationship had been broken off. And that's, you know, it speaks, I guess, somewhat to just the ickiness of the whole team when you lump in also Alan Dershowitz, who was an attorney for Jeffrey Epstein, who was accused and he was convicted of a really ugly crime, but he got a sweetheart deal. And there was allegations of obviously serial sex trafficking when he died. And just combine all this milieu of kind of ugliness and stink around the team itself. One that, you know, Monica Lewinsky, who was at the center of the last impeachment scandal, you know, kind of poignantly noted, made her say, "Are you freaking kidding me?" using a little bit more obscene language than that, though.
Monica Lewinsky weighs in on the selection of Starr to come back into the scene. And there's also Jay Sekulow, who you kind of tag, and a lot of people know him because he's already a Trump TV lawyer. He's on Fox a lot. Who you kind of tag with being pro-conservative Christian and anti-Muslim in his track record of taking cases?
Yeah, that's right. He, you know, he was a leading voice in opposing, along with Rudy Giuliani, the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, which was just an Islamic center in downtown Manhattan. And at the same time, he made his bones for his entire legal career, supposedly standing up for religious liberty, but in cases, again, for evangelical and causes of the Christian right, which just notes, you know, a kind of ugly religious hypocrisy there.
And there's the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. He succeeded Don McGahn in that role. For people who don't follow these things closely, remember McGahn, who famously resisted some of Trump's orders to him to hamper the Mueller investigation and testified about that to Mueller. That's the basis for some of the obstruction of justice charges that people wanted to bring against Trump. Don McGahn, Pat Cipollone replaced him and, let's say, hasn't been one of the grown-ups in the room in the same way?
Well, it's funny because, you know, the House impeachment managers just this morning, within, I guess, the last hour and a half or so, submitted a letter to Pat Cipollone asking him to either recuse himself or disclose everything he knows about the impeachment charges themselves, saying the claim being that he was deeply involved in both elements in both charges, obstruction of Congress and abuse of power. He was at the center of both of those incidents, and it's, you know, longstanding legal principles say you can't be a witness and a lawyer for the defendant at the same time, and that's just one of the many reasons why, you know, there are some big problems with Pat Cipollone as one of these attorneys.
This goes both ways, and I didn't know that Pat Cipollone breaking news until you just said it, but, you know, the Republicans have asked that Adam Schiff also either recuse himself or be forced to testify as a material witness on the Democrat side because allegedly or reportedly the whistleblower might have come to his staff before the whistleblower went through some of the Justice Department legal channels, and so people want Adam Schiff to testify. So neither of them are going to do it.
Yeah, I would say that the reasonable argument to say that the case is stronger for Cipollone is that the events that center on this charge of abuse of power, withholding aid from Ukraine in order to enact this pressure campaign to get them to investigate a chief political rival. Those incidents were reported to Pat Cipollone in real time, probably by the whistleblower sources. We know Fiona Hill and Alex Vindman and Tim Morrison, who were members of the national security team, all reported to John Eisenberg their concerns about the president's ask. And he reportedly directed those concerns to his direct superior, who was Pat Cipollone. So he was directly involved in this and is, you know, I would argue, more of a material witness.
I see that there's news in the last day after you wrote your article about Trump's defense team that Long Island Congressman Lee Zeldin from Suffolk County has been added to the president's defense team. His district, by way of background for our New York area listeners who don't live in Suffolk County and others listening around the country, his district did vote for Trump in 2016, but here in New York, we consider that a swing district. It has at times been held by Democrats not that long ago, and Zeldin's reelection in 2018 was close. But he goes on Fox a lot and he made his presence felt in the House impeachment hearings. So is it interesting to you? I don't know if you follow Lee Zeldin at all, but it looks to me in terms of, you know, the New York area congressional district politics that Zeldin has decided that his path to reelection this year must be through going all in with Donald Trump.
I follow the ins and outs of, you know, Suffolk County probably less closely than you do. But what I will say is that you're absolutely correct. And I just recall, again, from attending some of those impeachment inquiry hearings, how he was often in the front row with two or three other Freedom Caucus members, including Mark Meadows and Andy Biggs and others, just kind of sitting there observing and then playing defender already for the cameras and just in little scrums with reporters. And so he's been groomed and primed for this role for the last two or three months at the very least. And how he hopes that will play into his reelection campaign in Suffolk County, I would defer to you on that one, Brian.
And with Jeremy Stahl, who's covering the impeachment for Slate, let's take a phone call. David in McAllen, Texas. Hi, David, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You have a question.
Actually, yeah, thanks so much for taking my call. And I must say, here in McAllen, Texas, there is no crisis on this side of the border. All is good. My question is that, you know, we have so many serious issues at play these days in politics and in our national policy, and yet it seems like we have to accept the absurd, and we take the absurd seriously every day. We cover President Trump and his behavior with a sense of seriousness, and that this impeachment process seems equally absurd, that the Senate can have this moving target as to how the policies are going to take place, about how the procedures are going to take place. And they are the ones who are the defenders here. They're the ones who are being questioned, or at least represent the party that is under question. And I don't understand the intricacies of how the constitutional law applies to allowing that to happen, that it's this moving target. And it just points to the entire brokenness of the system, where there is no true transparency, where there is no true policy, and just wondering if what the historical precedent for that is, and if there is precedent to eventually change that.
David, thank you so much for that question. Jeremy, where would you like to jump in on that?
I would say that David was doing a very good job. He would have been a good advocate for what a lot of what the Democratic senators and the even House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, but particularly the minority leader Chuck Schumer, was saying yesterday. I think Chuck Schumer called it a national disgrace the way that this resolution laying out these rules were provided, you know, less than 24 hours before the start of the trial itself. There's no bipartisan basis. The historical precedent that it was that prior to the trial in 1999, in the last impeachment of Bill Clinton, there was a 100-0 unanimous vote for bipartisan procedures and a shared understanding of what a trial would look like. And what you have now instead is you're going to have one party voting on a party line and the other party voting on another party line, and basically what will allow one side to argue, fairly or not, that this process has been rigged from the start and that the trial itself is a cover-up, which is what they're already arguing. And in fairness, this is not how it's been in the past.
David, thank you so much for your call. Please call us again. One of the defense arguments taking center stage since Starr and Dershowitz were named is their position that even if everything in the articles is true, like abuse of power by conditioning military aid to Ukraine on their willingness to smear Joe Biden, these are not impeachable things. Here's Dershowitz on CNN.
You need a crime. Without a crime, there can be no impeachment.
Jeremy, this is interesting in part for how ahistorical it is. Did you know that people have already been impeached by the House and removed by the Senate for things other than actual crimes?
Yeah, and also, you know, in the impeachment charges against President Nixon that the Judiciary Committee voted on before he resigned, abuse of power was a charge and obstruction of Congress was a charge. And so there is historical precedent even for charges like this against a sitting president. So to our end, what constitutional scholars have said during the Judiciary Committee's impeachment hearing in the fall was that, you know, no, you don't need a crime for there to be a high crime. And in looking at how the founders laid out the notion of high crimes, they didn't know what the federal code and what the federal statutes and what the criminal statutes of 2020 the United States would be. So obviously they didn't mean that specifically it had to be felony USC 12B whatever in order to constitute a high crime and misdemeanor.
Right. In fact, I thought listeners who may be confused by this question being raised and not something that, you know, you spent a lot of time reading history about, might be interested to hear a few little things. One is the Wall Street Journal in October wrote this, that in addition to actual crimes, quote, Congress has made clear that it also believes violations of the public trust, even non-criminal ones, can be impeachable. The House has twice impeached judges for intoxication on the bench, resulting in their conviction or resignation. Congress has also impeached judges for favoritism, abuse of power, improper relationship with litigants, abuse of the contempt power, and arbitrary and oppressive conduct. So that from the Wall Street Journal, which, you know, on its editorial page tends to be pro-Trump on this. And just for everyone's curiosity, here's more on one of the cases cited there. This is the Wikipedia version on Judge John Pickering, the first person ever impeached and removed from office by the Senate. It says the House voted to impeach Pickering on March 2nd, 1803, on charges of drunkenness and unlawful rulings. Political controversy raged, with Federalists accusing Democratic Republicans, in those days they were the same party, the Democratic Republicans, of trying to usurp the Constitution by attempting to remove the judge from office, although he had committed neither high crimes nor misdemeanors. The Senate tried Pickering in absentia beginning in January 1804. The Senate convicted Pickering of all charges by a vote of 19-7 on March 12, 1804. Thereby immediately removing him from office. So isn't that interesting that early in our country's history, Jeremy, this exact controversy broke out. One party was accusing the other of an invalid impeachment because it needed to be a crime, but this guy got removed from a judgeship because he was drunk on the bench.
Yeah, that I would say is one of the weakest of their and most ahistorical of their arguments, this notion that there has to be a federal criminal offense. And that, you know, the cleaner version of the argument that was in the president's lengthy defense brief that was submitted over the weekend would just be, and even this is, it's harder, but it's a little bit easier to swallow, which is just that you don't know what the president's motives were. You can't charge him for abuse of power when his motives could have been as pure as snow, wanting an investigation of his chief political rival, Joe Biden, one of his chief political rivals, Joe Biden, because he wanted to get to the truth and stand up against corruption in Ukraine and against Burisma and against all these corrupt oligarchs. And that would have been a legitimate purpose. So you can't challenge him in doing that. And, you know, it strains credulity, obviously, with all the evidence that the House impeachment inquiry was able to gather, even despite the unprecedented obstruction of their efforts to get documents and witnesses. But that is at least a more believable and stronger argument, I would say, than claiming that, you know, you can't impeach him because he didn't do a crime.
Yeah, and just to put a point on it, on only crimes being impeachable, Dershowitz would also have to argue with Alexander Hamilton. Here is some Hamilton language from the Federalist Papers. In case you were wondering what I was doing before the show today, looking up things like Federalist 65 on the jurisdiction of impeachment. Quote, the subjects of its jurisdiction are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. There it is, abuse of power, abuse or violation of some public trust. They are of a nature which may, with peculiar propriety, be denominated political, as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself. And that last line, Jeremy, is so strikingly what the Democrats are talking about. And again, this is not to take a partisan position that the Democrats are right and Trump should be removed from office. But in terms of what this is about as an impeachment trial, Hamilton wrote, political as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself. And that's exactly the question on the table here. Is Trump injuring our society by the way he abuses power as president?
Yeah, and I would say I didn't have as wild of a morning looking up Federalist paper citations as you did, but that I would just add that one of the main concerns of the Founding Fathers, and I believe was addressed in the Federalist Papers, was this notion that a foreign power might be solicited to, you know, affect and impact an election by a corrupt president, and that in itself would be impeachable. It's directly discussed there, and that is precisely what the president has been accused of.
There are about 28 different things that I also wanted to talk about this morning, but guess what, folks? We will be talking about this every day at around this time. Probably our schedule here, since this show, unlike when they did the hearings in the House, and Jeremy, you can hang around for a little of this housekeeping between me and the audience. As a lot of our listeners know, when they did the impeachment hearings in the House, they would start at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and so this show got preempted a lot of times. The impeachment trial is going to be starting at 1 o'clock every afternoon, they tell us. So we are not going to be preempted at all, but probably we're going to talk about impeachment in the first segment most days, then talk about other things so we don't ignore the rest of life and the rest of the world and the rest of the news for the rest of the show. And then, of course, we'll go into impeachment trial mode at 1 o'clock. Most days we think you'll get the first hour of all of it with Allison Stewart, as usual, although today they're starting the coverage at noon, so Allison is completely preempted. But just a little housekeeping and some program notation there for you to know some of what is likely to come in the next days and few weeks. For today, we thank Jeremy Stahl, senior editor for Slate. Jeremy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian. Have a great day.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.